Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 12th episode of The Robots Are Coming. Today, we have two very special guests, Brian Zhu and Ravi Patel. They are two of the members of our latest project, Demo Draft, which is the Kickstarter for politics. So without further ado, can we have Ravi first introduce himself, please?
Yeah, very happy to be on here. Just brief introduction. My name is Rob.
I'm a rising high school senior in Portland, Oregon. And yeah, I'm really excited to be helping out on this, like, it's kind of like a passion project, but also we do have a goal in mind. I think we see a bright future, especially, you know, I think all of us have our own collections of experiences. I'm super, super excited to see it all come together here.
Brian was actually someone I met at a summer camp, I think, like, oh, I don't even know how many years ago. Like
before. That was like 2016, so it was 4 years ago.
Yeah,
it's
a math summer camp, and we played basketball together, and it was a nice experience. But I would say, like, Brian struck out to me as, you know, incredibly unique in the sense that he's in this position where he's intensely passionate and good at, you know, both math competitions and politics. And that's a very unique combination of interests. So, you know, that's kind of how I got to know Brian. Ravi, would you like to say, you know, how you got in touch with our team and, you know, where your strengths and interests lie?
Yeah. You know, I mentioned I'm studying economics, but that ties primarily into policy and law. I am pre-law, hoping to go to law school. And I compete on Berkeley's mock trial team, so that's kind of feeds that interest. In terms of how I was able to get involved with such a good project, one of my friends, Mark, was doing legal work for you guys for a bit. You know, Mark and I have been friends for all of my first year at UC Berkeley. We actually met a couple weeks before we moved in. And, you know, he reached out to me, got me on the team. And I would say, you know, this project fulfills a lot of my interests, right? I mean, the econ business side of things and, you know, law and policy.
Yeah, and what struck me about Ravi is that you're extremely well-spoken, you know, a lot about, you know, policy and economics, and, you know, you bring a really great perspective to the team, and you know, that perspective is, you know, through the progressive lens, and, you know, that's something that we sort of need for our team, because, you know, with Demo Draft, you know, we're sort of approaching this area of nonpartisan Chip, and, you know, Ravi presents this, you know, whole new lens of progressivism and, you know, economics, which is a great addition for a team. So, yeah, thank you for coming on to the team, Ravi. Appreciate your efforts.
Happy to be here. Yeah.
Now, next thing we're going to move into is, you know, how do you two view the intersection between Demo Draft and, you know, the implications of technology on politics?
I think it's an interesting thing to talk about. And for our current, like, standpoint in the world, like, it's kind of like a transition phase in which, like, technology increasingly becomes more of a part of our life, right? I mean, most shopping nowadays is, like, done online. Instead of in person, you know, we have social media is literally like the most primary form of contact we have with other people. And in a sense, like tech is always evolving, but our laws have to change in order to also address the rising significance of technology. I think the Demo Draft endeavor is one that kind of doesn't see technology as something that policy has to adapt to, but rather, like, you know, some way that tech can also play a role in shaping the political landscape and changing how that front works. I mean, I don't know if the goal of DemoDraft has been explained yet, but essentially, you know, trying to reshape the campaign finance landscape, and making, you know, making it possible for people who want to get involved into politics to have a way and a platform to engage with other people. So, you know, it's a really interesting combination of tech and politics.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty solid way of putting it. I would say the intersection between tech and politics generally and how DemoDraft fits into that kind of can be characterized in two ways. The first would be growth, and the second would be kind of misinformation slash like factual accuracy. With regards to growth, you know, a lot of campaigns that I worked on, I'm on my fourth right now. A lot of progressive ones tend to not be, you know, corporate PAC funded. And so a very common sloganeering type theme that's throughout all of them is like people, not PACs, or like an emphasis on people power. And I think a platform like ours that we're working on gives people a place to essentially organize, you know, other people in a way, right? It's almost like, you know, when you're going on social media, when you're marketing on there, you know, it doesn't cost any money to make an account, right? So when you make an account on some of these platforms, you can almost, you know, gain tons and tons of supporters that you otherwise wouldn't have had, you know, just by organizing and posting things, right? It's almost like free advertising, right? You don't really have to pay for it. It's not paid media. With regards to misinformation and factual accuracy, I think a big part of why we have ideological diversity, yeah, you know, I mentioned Mark, for example, right? And he's a right-leaning Republican who actually brought me on. We're great friends, even though we disagree on most issues, right? I think the factual accuracy component comes into our team because we're looking to create a space where it transitions from being a toxic echo chamber to a place of more positive debate, right? And I think that's something we've been losing on platforms like Twitter, where essentially people fall into the same sort of places that they always agree with, right? Conservatives watching Fox News, Tucker Carlson, right? And then, you know, people on the left watching CNN, MSNBC. I think our platform being nonpartisan actually helps in that way. Just the two ways, growth and then misinformation.
Yeah. Another important part is like the platform aims to be blind to parties. It's more issue centered, which is why, like, you know, if you were to open up the app, the first thing you see isn't like the politicians' political leanings, but rather like a whole collection of issues, which stresses again that politics shouldn't be party centered, but ideologically centered.
Yeah. And, you know, especially when it comes to, we're talking about corporate PACs and how they can sort of bend Washington politicians to their will using money. I think an important thing with that is understanding where politicians lie, right? They're not beholden to a group that's just going to pay them money to advance a certain policy, but that they're beholden to the people, right? One of our main missions, just to reiterate, is to elect people from their communities rather than corporations. And I think that's really impactful because, you know, a lot of community organizers, people that are working in public service, people that are, you know, working in nonprofits, for example, they don't have the same sort of financial pull that, you know, maybe someone who just moved a decade or 5 years ago into the community and has just tons and tons of corporate power because of, you know, existing wealth or inherited wealth has, right? And, you know, platforms like ours seek to equalize that playing ground.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of one of our inspiration to founding DemoDraft is we see the statistics of how dark money has run amok in American politics. And there's this misalignment of incentives, you know, between the American people and money and capitalism. So it's a very interesting question how we can align these incentives, because we are a startup. So in the future, we're going to find a way to make money while sticking true to our mission of holding true these ideals without letting money get in the way of our product or of our vision. So, you know, just out of curiosity, you know, to both of you, do you think that is something that is possible, or are we just, you know, wasting our time on something that's fundamentally impossible?
That's a good question.
With regards to the question, just what specific aspect are you saying is impossible when it comes to capitalism and getting corporate money out?
Like impossible as in, you know, the way I kind of think about it is, do you have like a vector of the American people's will in like one direction? And then maybe the incentives of capitalism and dark money is in another. And that depends on kind of the corporation, the super PACs and the constituents. So these two vectors, you know, they're definitely not parallel right now because they're in conflict with each other. But, you know, in the future, what would you see as sort of the angle between these two vectors? And could we using our product, align them in a way that gets them to become parallel? It's a very abstract analogy, but yeah, feel free to interpret it however you want.
I mean, I think part of it is that all of these big tech companies, at least the executives at the top, seem inaccessible to the average, you know, common American person. And so what they do is separate from what the American people express as their concerns and priorities. And that can, you know, explain why the vectors point in different directions. But I think this question of like whether or not in, you know, American capitalism, whether or not people with money and the people who just are citizens of the country can have the same priorities, I think that comes down to like who's in control of tech and who has access to resources that gives them the platform. And that resource, the big one being money. I think the vectors will become more aligned if, you know, more people get into like technology and more people have access and the ability to start working in that area. But I don't know. I think it's an interesting question, not one that I've like pondered before.
I think a big portion of it when we're talking about a divide between like the working class, blue collar workers, and sort of this new frontier of tech and politics is education, right? I think that's just true with tech in general. You know, a lot of times, obviously, like you're able to get involved with certain products without a certain amount of training or education. But, you know, when you look at the highest paying jobs, for example, in tech, you know, it's not usually the non-technical roles, right? I mean, there's obviously like, you know, there's business roles and everything, but usually it requires you to have some sort of, say, college education, right? It requires you to, you know, have some sort of training in computer science, maybe in finance, you know, something that's very technical. And, you know, being able to go to a top university, get recruited out of that into a big tech company, and then rise your way through the ranks is, you know, much less accessible to someone who's doesn't have a level of generational wealth. Just sort of have a personal example to bring in. You know, many members of my own family, you know, we've been lucky to have quite a bit of generational wealth, right? Indian Americans have been brought in as, you know, high education, high wealth type people. And they've been, you know, working in white collar roles. So, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers. And as a result, not only do they have more capital in the short term, right? They have, you know, higher salaries and everything, but they're able to put away more for their kids to essentially have better access to not just colleges, but schools from the ground up, right? So K through 12, people who are living in Silicon Valley, for example, are going to have a much better experience than, say, a rural family living in Appalachia or, you know, someone grown up in the inner city. So when we're talking about things like systemic racism, for example, that kind of links into this, and the role of capital, I think education is probably, you know, if not number one, at least like a top three issue in that regard, right? Especially when it comes to educating yourself on issues. A lot of the average Americans who sort of are at the whims of some of these economic policy decisions don't really understand how it all works, you know, where the money goes, who's in charge of it, and how they can sort of maximize the system to make it work for them and their families.
Yeah, and in a way, like, the system is stacked against them. Like, for example, how we finance public education, that's from, like, local income tax, property tax, depending on where you're from. Like, even within schools, like, our legislators sometimes don't have the best idea just how segregated schools can be, not like within schools, but from, you know, different geographical areas within a city, like because of processes in the 20th century, like redlining and gentrification, like it's just been worse. It's been a decline for probably, you know, decades on end, but it hasn't, the situation hasn't gotten any better. I mean, you can see it. And I looked up these statistics, which were honestly kind of shocking for me, like from the UC school system, like UC Berkeley has an African-American population of about like 2%, right? Which is an underrepresentation of African-Americans in California, while other UCs, which are often seen as like kind of the lower quality UCs, like UC Merced, Riverside, those have a overrepresentation of African-American people. So I don't think there's enough emphasis being put on just how bad the racial prejudices in the system are. And that's inherent. It's like, even if the legislators aren't intending for it, like this is the way that American history has played out, and this is the impact and what we're left with.
Yeah, I think part of that also ties into the underfunding of, you know, public schools in general and communities of color. And, you know, you're talking about segregation, redlining and stuff. That's kind of also maintained itself all the way to the present day. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think both of you kind of echo this idea. We need to be funneling capital into education as opposed to directly into politics. And then in turn, you know, people can receive enough awareness around political issues and making informed decisions for their legislators. So, you know, kind of all of us have been through this education system, either public or private school. And you mentioned like this great disparity between different schools. You know, and maybe our platform is potentially can be viewed as an education platform where everyone can gain equal access to decent, well-documented information and then use it to make informed decision. Like, have you thought about demo draft in that perspective from like an education perspective before? And if so, you know, how do you think they're related?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concept of the platform is very simple. Like anyone can sign up, or the goal is for anyone to be able to sign up for anyone to be able to access all the resources that are on the platform. From an educational standpoint, it's like kind of the same concept as like Khan Academy or something, where it's an open source and anyone can join in and gain access to learning. That's really critical for our current time. So I think that it definitely plays a role in the political side of education.
Yeah. I also think part of it too is like, you know, with platforms like Khan Academy and, you know, other tech platforms, I think of Coursera as well is another one where it's kind of, you know, user focused. With regards to disparities in education, you know, obviously like some people on this call are from, I believe, the South Bay, from San Jose. I think maybe one of us is from Palo Alto. I'm not quite sure.
But let's see. Where is everyone from? We should say that.
Yeah, where is everyone from?
So I'm in Stanford right now. I'm in Palo Alto. But originally, I grew up in China, and so it's a pretty different system there, but I did go to like a international school in China. So it's kind of the same curriculum, AP, IB. Coming to here also, you know, being in Palo Alto also gives a different perspective. Well, yeah, what about you, Ken?
Yeah, I was born and raised in San Jose, and I moved around East and South San Jose, for most of my life. So I got a taste of what it's like in San Jose, and then I moved to Berkeley for college. So two different perspectives, moving from Santa Clara County all the way to Alameda County. So it's a lot different, in my view.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Portland. I was actually born in Berkeley, but I was two when I moved, so I don't remember a single thing. But I've grown up in kind of the more affluent suburbs around Portland. So, you know, Portland isn't like, it's not thought of like a techie city, but it's getting to be on that side. And so some very interesting developments in the city, and also from my perspective of kind of being in this like Asian American enclave of sorts in Portland. Like, yeah, like I think when we're talking about education, it's a really unique perspective.
Yeah. To round it out, you know, I'm from a much sort of different area. I'm from the far northern part of California, Shasta County, specifically the city of Redding. It's, you know, population about 100,000, but it's rural in nature in terms of not just the economy, but the way it's spread out. And that's kind of shown itself in the way our public schools have been sort of funded, maybe underfunded, right? We have two kind of more higher end schools in the district, Shasta, which is the one I went to, and then UPREP, which is kind of a more direct pipeline to high end universities. Then there's a couple others that are much, you know, not as well funded. And, you know, the sad thing is that, you know, one of them is in kind of the more urban part of the district, but it gets less funding, right? Even though there's more sort of population density there. Another couple of schools are out in the country where, you know, a lot of people generally don't have an existing network of education. So, you know, we're talking about places like Portland, places like San Jose. These are already kind of tech-centric areas. And I think it's not exactly the easiest thing for, you know, people from my area when they go to these top colleges or when they're trying to go into just tech in general at top companies. It tends to be a little bit harder, right? My econ professor this spring was talking a lot about knowledge spillovers as kind of a big concept. Essentially, when you're surrounded by people that have a high level of, you know, what's called human capital or education, essentially, you know, your quality of the product you can produce as a worker in tech, you know, it goes up drastically, right? Because you're able to sort of work with others. It's kind of like a self-reinforcing cycle, right? You just don't have that cycle in areas like the one I grew up in.
Yeah, I mean, that concept is really interesting because most of my entire life, like, I think the emphasis in our community has been put on, you know, excelling through school, making sure that you have like the best possible chance of making it to one of these top colleges. And the end goal was to, you know, have one of those jobs that you described before, be a doctor, a lawyer, work in computer science, I don't know, like all of these jobs, which carry a lot of, you know, capital with them. You can make a lot of money doing these jobs. Like these are jobs that are stressed in our communities. And so it's very easy for one of us to go there, whereas someone who, you know, might come from the countryside or, you know, even 20 minutes out from Portland, they don't get the same circles. They don't have the same reinforcement of values and future. So it's a really interesting dynamic and it can explain a lot of disconnect.
Yeah, just one final comment to sort of tackle onto that. You know, a big issue with that also, if we're thinking tech, is rural broadband access. So out here where I'm from, you know, our congressional district has pretty poor rural broadband access. And as a result, you know, that disparity bleeds in a lot with education, right? Broadband for assembly campaigns and for congressional campaigns is a very politically salient topic. So, you know, when we're talking about making education more accessible and getting people more involved in tech, I think the first step, obviously, in some of these communities is making sure they have proper internet, right? You know, that's a big issue as well.
Would you guys, you know, say that it made the lack of education or just disconnect in education with all these problems, like lack of Wi-Fi in rural areas, you know, is that perhaps responsible for the kind of hyper-partisan environment that we see in politics today? Why people came to shape such different opinions?
I think when we're talking about like access to tech and stuff, like in a way, we can see how tech can offer a place for people to have good conversations about like actual conversation grounded in civility and stuff when it comes to politics, which is one argument saying that more access to technology is a better way to curb hyper partisanship. But it's interesting to say because, I mean, most of us know that like blue states or, you know, blue areas are usually those that are centered in super high density populations. We're talking the big cities. Those are usually always blue, while in the rural areas, those are red. But I don't think that it necessarily has to do with tech. I feel like it's more like a cultural thing.
I think another thing is also kind of the dynamic between like public and private when we're looking at systems for educating the youth K through 12. You know, we have sort of Trump administration officials like Betsy DeVos trying to solve the problem by just peeling back all the regulations, privatizing certain aspects of the school system. And then you have people on the left that are kind of looking to, you know, ban charter schools and just sort of, you know, direct more and more of that money into a more robust public school system. So, you know, I think transitioning to kind of a discussion of, you know, tech and politics, you have to look at where the money for some of these officials comes from, right? You know, where are they getting their paycheck from? And a lot of these officials that want to privatize things like, you know, K through 12 education all the way, they're getting money from corporate interests, right? And, you know, this might be my progressive democratic socialist side talking here, but with regards to, you know, capital, a conversation there, you're not going to get much change progressively in politics if everyone who's making decisions is just getting money from corporations, right? And I think Ken, during my interview for Demo Draft, brought that up with a quote from Robert Reich, who's a professor at Berkeley.
Yeah, very, very good way to characterize the differences.
And hopefully, you know, I think through Demo Draft, you know, we hope to even the playing field with education, with politics, with dark money, and I think that, you know, hopefully one day we can make democracy what it truly is, you know, by the people and for the people. And, you know, we're committed to doing that. And I think with our team and our efforts, you know, we can do this. So I just want to wrap this up and thank all of you for joining our podcast interview. We appreciate Ravi and Brian coming on to sharing your perspectives. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. Been a lot of fun.